Adriano Adewale. Join me, Martin Handley, for music from the City of London Festival in Performance on 3, Wednesday and Thursday at 7, here on BBC Radio 3.
And now, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Dame Barbara Stocking has been chief executive of Oxfam since 2001. That's meant that she's had to lead Oxfam's response to major crises like tsunami, the Pakistan earthquake, the problems in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Sudan. In a way, that must be a pretty harrowing occupation for a lot of the time, but rewarding sometimes.
Yes, I mean, it's not harrowing to me, because actually I have the opportunity to see that we're doing work that is making such a difference. I think if I was going without that opportunity, it would feel very different. As it is, I'm just there trying to make sure that we are doing the very best we can to people who are really in dire need.
Oxfam gets its money from where?
About half from the British public, and that is either in people who give regular monthly donations or, of course, quite a bit through our shops, the 710 shops network in the UK, and about half from government institutions, but not just the UK. And we get a lot from the UN, from ECHO, the humanitarian part of the European Union, and so on. So it's about half and half.
It is one of the organisations that has managed to hold its head high, I think. But I know a lot of people do worry about how much money that they give goes on administration and things like that. Can you reassure them?
Oh, I can absolutely reassure them. The overall amount that sort of, you know, the running of the organisation is only about 3%. Of course, there are management costs in country because you can't run your programmes without having your office there. But no, our money gets absolutely out there. And I go out there myself and see all those people who benefited, and over the years, not just things we're doing now.
So you must travel pretty extensively.
Yes, I spend about a third of my time, I think, out of the UK. Four trips a year, usually, to places where we've got our programmes, both the humanitarian ones that you were just talking about a minute ago, but of course, about half our money is spent on long-term development, particularly in rural areas.
Like getting water to villages.
Well, getting water, but actually agriculture is the key thing. Really, we've got some fantastic projects where small farmers get together in producer organisations and really do so much better because they've got the volume to sell into markets, both local markets, but also to some of the major multinational companies now. So really seeing them grow and develop is fantastic.
And I suppose really your job involves quite a lot of give and take with government and World Health Organization and things like
and
that.
And all those, yes, it certainly does. I spend a lot of my time lobbying, but I regard lobbying as a relationship activity that you have to engage with people. Yes, it's obviously the governments in the countries where we work are one of the people, as well as governments in the UK, but a lot around the UN as well, where of course, both on the conflict side, where you're looking at peacekeeping forces and so on, but also the humanitarian agencies that we work in partnership with.
Well, we'll come back to Oxfam, but you're going to lobby on behalf of music for
that's wonderful
most of the time. And I think that it was quite important to you from quite an early age. I mean, you learned the piano at school.
Yeah. No, I learned the piano, well, at home, you know, sort of lessons. So, I mean, I come from a very ordinary working class background. My father was a postman, for example, but they really believed in education, my parents. And one of the things was you should learn the piano, which I was very happy to do. It wasn't that the family had a whole load of music around, though. I was thinking about it and I think, well, my parents were members of the Methodist Church, and of course there was a huge amount of singing there, which probably maybe influences some of my taste. But I got really singing sort of seriously when my school matched up, it was a girls' high school state, matched up with Rugby School, which is where I lived, for some great work every year. And one of the first ones I ever sang was Bach's Mass in B minor, and that's one that, if you're not used to it, hits you straight in the stomach.
Well, I often think, and we've mentioned this on this programme before, that people often think that sports gives people an idea of teamwork and leadership.
Yes.
But actually singing in choirs has a very similar effect.
It does. And we even use that, actually, both when I was working in the health service and now in Oxfam, that you can do teamwork training, actually, by singing, which is great.
So which bit of the Bach B minor mass shall we home in on?
It's gratias agimus tibi. And the reason for that is because I think I had a fantastic sound upbringing in which it was very clear what the values were, very clear the community life. And it's, I feel like that gave me such a present in setting out on life, in that I knew who I was and I feel very sort of centred about myself. And that is an enormous gift. So this is a little thank you.
I was just thinking that what an amazingly majestic sound Bach gets from essentially do, re, mi, fa.
Yeah. No, really great, really great.
And then
great.
Back again. Yes, the Gratias Agimus Tibi from the Mass in B minor by Bach, the Bavarian Radio Choir and Symphony Orchestra conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. So, did you feel at that point that music was going to be a constant companion?
I don't know that I knew, really. I mean, it always sort of was there, but not in great depth, really. But again, coming from a fairly simple background, I sort of grew into it. You know, the world of music opened up as I grew up, really, in a wonderful way. And for a long time, there was always something new and, well, there still is, and always sort of new areas to move into, which was great.
You were talking about how you had the good fortune to be very centred as a child because of your family. But so many of the children you must see have endless uncertainty around them.
They do, they do. And again, I suppose one of the things I find in my travels is that people actually, where I go, sing and dance far more than I ever see in the UK, and all ages. And that includes children. And I think if you've got very little, you do create your own entertainment and your own sense of community and values. And of course, music plays an enormous part of that. And we use music with children a lot in trying to help them, in terms of education, actually, hygiene, when we're you will laugh at this. I'm probably the most sung to in terms of diarrhea songs that there are in the world, because we do water and sanitation and we teach children hygiene by singing, basically. So wherever I go, I always get a song sung to me by children on the matter, really.
Well, actually, Mozart, I was going to say, this is perhaps not an appropriate introduction, except that he was also obsessed about bottoms and things.
So maybe
he would have enjoyed this.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go to a higher level than that, I hope.
Well, we are, because in fact it was at Cambridge, wasn't it, that you first really got a passion for opera.
Obviously going to Cambridge was a wonderful experience too. But going down to London from Cambridge with a boyfriend in a borrowed car to sort of my first great sort of Royal Opera House, Verdi, Forza di Destina and Otello, that was the start of my lifelong sort of love affair with opera. But I think it's not just the music, it is the spectacle of it all. It's the way you get drawn into the whole story and the acting and the colour and everything, just fantastic.
I'm sure that in a way your experience of singing Bach earlier probably helped you to that, because some people encountering opera for the first time find it like an alien planet.
No, I didn't at all. Mind you, I had been through a rather bad school version of Purcell's Dido and singing a witch, I think I was, or something horrible. But anyway, so I had a little bit, but that would probably have put me off opera. But anyway, I got onto the real thing and that was tremendous.
Which is music from Mozart next?
Yes.
The Marriage of Figaro, and which part in particular?
Oh, Cherubino's love song. But it could have been, frankly, it could have been anything from Marriage of Figaro. It really is, well, I think it is the great work of anything, really.
Perhaps, yes. I mean, I think musicians in particular think it's one of the most perfect operas ever written.
It's got so much in it, so many different things, so many different sorts of music.
Non troppo c'era, te le di, ma per me più.
Angelika Kirschlager sang Voi che sapete from The Marriage of Figaro, Act 2 by Mozart, with Concerto Köln, directed by René Jacobs. It was about this time, I think, wasn't it, when you at Cambridge, that you began to feel quite an urge to travel and to see those countries that were perhaps less privileged.
Yes, and I don't know quite where that came from. I can understand where the concern from inequality came from, because that was sort of part of the upbringing. But why I got this urge to travel so much, I don't know. But certainly from that age, I was very keen to get into international development. I was one of those 18-year-olds who wanted to save the world at the time, that sort of feeling. But particularly, I don't know whether it was the time, sort of, you know, the late 60s, when I think a lot of people did feel that they wanted to go out and do something in the world, and certainly Africa. To me was a big part of that, you know, all the people going doing voluntary service overseas and things. And so I was very keen to get into international development, though, in fact, that didn't happen until I was about 28. In its own way, that wasn't a bad thing. I do think if you're doing international development, it's quite good to have had done things in your own career first, rather than thinking that you can go out and save the world with, you know, no skills to offer. So
one of the things that must be quite frustrating for you, well, I think there are lots doing what you do, yeah, but one in particular is that it's one thing when you're dealing with, say, a tsunami or a natural act, yeah, of God, yeah, as it were, of nature, but it must be particularly awful when you're dealing with things that actually we've brought upon ourselves as human beings by, you know, war, violence,
yes,
whatever.
Yes. Well, it is. I mean, in a sense, I focus on the people that we're working with. But also, again, because Oxfam is a lobbying organisation, you know, Oxfam really believes you can change the world. And again, that gives that dynamic sense of doing things that may bring about change. And often I think we're thought of as quite naive in what we can change, and maybe we don't get as far as the great ambition, but things do change. I remember when I left the NHS, Oxfam was just starting a campaign to get medicines to people in poor countries through changing the pharmaceutical industry. And all my colleagues in the Department of Health said, you know, this is completely naive, you'll never do anything. And in the course of that campaign, the costs of drugs for HIV/AIDS just absolutely dropped dramatically. So you can do things. And again, I think that's the encouragement. But there have been moments when I've met one or two sort of dictators and despots, and I've wondered quite where the world was going to, really.
I suppose one country where one does feel that things have got better, not entirely, but in some respects, is indeed in South Africa. They've got, yeah, new problems,
yeah,
but
yeah,
at least,
yeah,
thing. And one, strange enough, one of the things that helped that, I think, was the music, and the music getting,
yes,
to the wider world. One thinks of Paul Simon and Grace,
yeah,
Lynch,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
those wonderful choirs.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's why I've chosen the next one. It's really it's in part of my life cycle. It was a bit of bringing in Africa, and it's Nkosi Sikelel' Africa, which is actually not just the national anthem of South Africa, but also, I think, Malawi and Zimbabwe as well, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's a real sense of Africa, and it's a women's group singing it, which is a big part of, again, my sort of life, actually, obviously as a woman, but also in Oxfam, because, you know, 70% of the world's poor people are women and girls, so it's nice to hear a women's group singing it too.
Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, Malu pakamisu pangolwayo, Yizwa imitandazo yetu, Nkosi Sikelel' Sapoloyo, Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, Malu pakamisu pangolwayo, Yizwa imitandazo yetu, Nkosi Sikelel' Tina, Lusapoloyo. Morena buluka si chabasa esu,
ou fait disait dit toi li m'a soigné
ou si vous louquez
ou si vous louquez
ou si vous louquez morena
ou si vous louquez si chabasa Pagate Magu Benjalo Magu Benjalo Gude Gubengula Pagate Gude Gubengula Pagate
Amala
Awe
Women of the Calabash and Nkosi Sikelel iAfrika.
That reminds me of a wonderful experience in Zambia when I was at an HIV/AIDS workshop in the middle of the country, sleeping in a mud hut. And though I was still an honoured guest, sort of, but the people at the workshop, the women, all women from the workshop, walked about 2 kilometres in the evening to come and join us for supper. And they sang their whole way through the bush to us with their torches and their singing. It was fantastic. It was a bit like that then.
People always say that, you know, art and artists can't change history, can't change politics, but it can certainly not only just comfort people, but give them some way of expression.
Again, music is a great way to bring people together and share something, and you can put it to a cause or just enjoyment, but it's all there. It makes community.
Actually, we saw that in football too, didn't we?
Yes,
with Pavarotti and the anthem. And in fact, it was a 3 tenors concert, I think, at the 1990 World Cup, where you possibly encountered this next piece.
Yeah, well, I didn't actually hear it too much later because I'm not a big football fan. But this is Jose Carreras and singing Granada. And the reason I chose that, well, first of all, this is what I put on in the morning when I'm in a grey, cold Oxford winter, going to work on a day when there might be a few problems. And then I stick Granada on the CD and belt it out, and I've then got the energy for the day. And the reason I think that comes through is I know that at that time, Jose Carreras had, I think, just recovered from a pretty serious disease. And when I hear him singing in that 3 tenors concert, it feels like a man who's just been given life back. He's absolutely, he puts his whole heart and soul into it. And I feel like, well, if he can do that, I can get on with the day.
And also you rather like the
Oh,
the
I love
Latin
the R's. I love the Latin part of this, The R's are very sexy. And the great music for dancing too.
Granada, tierra soñada por mí, mi cantar se vuelve gitano cuando es para ti. Mi cantar hecho de fantasía, mi cantar flor de melancolía. Preciosa cosa che darte che un ramo de rosas de rosas de suave fragancia che le diera Marco alla Virgen morena Granada de rosas de suave fragancia que le diera Marco Granada, tu tierra española, gringas mujeres de sangre.
Certainly enjoying themselves there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Funnily enough, that song about Spain is actually a very famous Mexican song.
Oh, I didn't know that actually.
Yeah, by Agustin Lara, right. Granada. The recording came from the three tenors concert at the 1990 World Cup, as I said. We heard José Carreras with the orchestras of the Maggio Musicale Florence and the Rome Opera, conducted by Zubin Mehta. It was a concert in Rome. Well, we've now had some quite colourful and extravagant gestures. So I wonder, Barbara Stocking, whether chamber music is also a love of yours.
Yeah, it's a thing I grew into later. And certainly, oh, it's not that I hadn't heard chamber music, but I think it really became a much more part of my life after meeting my husband, who's absolutely obsessed with chamber music and string quartets and so on. So, and in fact, the first date that we went on was to three Bartok string quartets. I'm afraid I'm still not stuck on Bartok, but nevertheless, he got me really going in the whole sort of business of string quartets.
I'm with him. I think you should...
I know, I should try harder.
They're incredibly rewarding.
Yes.
But you survived that anyway.
Oh, I survived that. And we got married as a result.
Yes.
So that's good. And it got me into a lot of string quartets because there's always someone at home. It's all over the place, the sort of chamber music and things. But I love some of the Haydn ones as well. But I mean, the one I've chosen is actually Borodin. But that's partly because it's got a different sort of memory for me because for a long time when we got two boys and when our children were little, we spent holidays sort of, you know, the usual cottage in France, but going to all those little local music events, and it was there that I actually, surprisingly, quite late on, heard the second Borodin string quartet for the very first time, and sort of fell in love with that one really too.
Thank you.
That was the Notturno, the third movement of Borodin's second string quartet in D, played there by the Lindsays. You mentioned, Barbara Stocking, how for Oxfam you encountered an enormous number of people with AIDS, and I wonder how that particular fight is progressing.
Well, in some ways, movement is taking place. I mean, one of the biggest and best things to happen is that, partly because the aid budgets have gone up from countries like the UK, enormous amounts of money have gone into health services in, say, Southern Africa, and antiretroviral therapy is now available to people. And it's phenomenal that even in the short time that I've been with Oxfam, the countries I've been to, I now see a big difference in that with those treatments, people are, they're not cured, but they're now carrying on with life in quite a different way. But of course, it's not something that's gone. I mean, it is being passed on, so, you know, very heavily still.
So as much as the kind of treatment, the education is what's so important.
The education
to stop it in
very,
the first place,
and
yeah.
The leadership fundamentally. I mean, the countries that have done the best in dealing with HIV/AIDS is other than the countries that first came out and said we've got a problem, and actually we're going to do something about it and not try and hide from it. Really, I mean, Uganda was one of the earliest ones in those cases, but it's still a really severe and awful problem.
Sometimes one musician can focus attention.
I think I know where you're going.
on an area, and somebody who did that wonderfully in recent years was Daniel Barenboim, of course.
Not only
Barenboim, but also
Edward Said.
Edward Said, yes. They developed the East West Divan Orchestra,
yeah.
And that, of course, did had a marvellous effect in that he actually got Israeli and Arab musicians, young ones playing together.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that was just great. And that's why I actually chose Barenboim in this. I mean, not that he's, you know, I mean, he's a superb artist in so many respects anyway, but it was that sort of extra thing that he used music to bring people together. And I suppose what's so strong about that is there are some conflicts that are so intractable that trying to get people to actually talk about the conflicts themselves and deal with that is more than you can do. You can't sit people down and say, let's go and talk about your views about this and your histories and all that. You've got to start somewhere else. And I think what he's done is to give music the place where you can go that is neutral and work together and understand each other as human beings and that music with it. So it's a fantastic achievement.
But rather like Dudamel and his orchestra with all his children, it's no good if the quality's not there somehow, is it? But with him, with Barenboim and Dudamel, the quality really is there, and something miraculous happens. Not only bringing these people together, but in their making of music.
Yeah, but you sort of wonder if it doesn't go together because that's the same thing happening, that it's such an unusual moment. I mean, clearly he chose his, you know, musicians who were really very good, but the magic of it may spring from that sense of the unusualness. I mean, it's not a boring old concert in a concert hall somewhere. It's actually people doing, they're placed together in quite an unusual situation, which in a sense maybe gets the adrenaline up a bit as well.
Yeah, so that in fact you are kind of breathing for life, as it were.
Yes.
Well, we're going to hear Barenboim both playing the piano and directing,
yes,
not with the East West Divan Orchestra, but the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, but you've chosen a Mozart piano concerto. Any particular reason for this?
Well, not just that I love Mozart, and I suppose a bit of playing the piano from my youth, but I sort of wanted another bit of Mozart, and also another bit of orchestral music, because I realised when I was choosing these that nearly all mine have got sort of human voice in it, and I need a bit of quietness as well sometimes. And these, both the string quartets and the piano concertos, are the sorts of things that I used to play. I was in the health service, and I was a regional director, and I used to cover a patch from Oxford to Great Yarmouth. So I drove rather a long way. And that sort of music, you know, the sort of things like the Mozart piano concerto were the sort of things that I would have on to keep me going on those journeys.
Thank you.
Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 27 in B-flat, of which that was the second movement, the Larghetto, was played by Daniel Barenboim, who also directed the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. I suppose one of the things that you have to really think about at Oxfam is the future and try and think ahead of these disasters. And I suppose climate change must rear its head quite ominously there.
Yes, we made a big decision about 3 years ago to say we have to move on the issues of climate change, not just because of the issues themselves, but because they are already affecting poor people so heavily, partly because since the 90s, the number of extreme weather events has doubled, but also because people everywhere we go say the seasons have changed and we don't know why and they don't know when to plant and their crops washed away and so on. So, yes, last year we were campaigning very heavily towards the Copenhagen negotiations to get a deal on climate change that was good for poor people. But it's changing all our work on the ground as well, and meaning that we need to develop up local partners, local government much more, particularly on the emergency side, so they can deal with things themselves.
It is extraordinary, really, when you think that we were talking about those children who managed to somehow have great contentment and even find fun with songs and dancing and without any of the consumerism of the West.
Yes.
And yet it's the governments of the West that quite often fail to sort of agree to do those things which would make climate change perhaps slightly less dangerous than it might be.
Well, that was the sadness of Copenhagen, that the global leaders of all sorts actually just couldn't bring themselves to see that they needed to do something for the world rather than their own particular country's interests. And that was a failure of global governments to actually deliver something for its people. But, you know, you've just got to go on. You can't, you know, that was a failure, but climate change is not going to go away, so we shall certainly keep
campaigning. What kind of things can you do, though? I mean, campaigning, of course, but I mean, on the ground.
On the ground. Oh, we take Bangladesh, for example, by actually helping the communities know what to do in terms of reducing the risk when things happen, when cyclones hit. They can be really prepared. They can be prepared by mobile phone systems to make sure they know it's coming so they can go to higher ground, but also things like the building up of banks and so on, making sure there are shelters on higher ground, kitchens, food and so on there. So, I mean, the difference in lives lost in the recent cyclones is fantastic compared to, say, about 1999, when thousands of people died. And yet in the cyclones recently, it's been relatively few, though the suffering's still been very great. So you can help communities enormously in how to cope and survive. But there are limits to this. I mean, some of the places in Bangladesh, people are now effectively drinking salt water, and salt water has stopped agriculture on their lands, and it really is unsustainable. So it's changing, and they're going to have to face some bigger issues there.
Finally, some more Latin American.
Yes, I'm going to be in deep trouble for this, actually.
Why?
Well, I was thinking, you know, the world music part of this, you know, I've done a bit of Africa, and I've had two Latin American songs. And
yeah, but you didn't know that, did you?
I didn't know Laura was Mexican, no.
Well, I can help you out there, because Franco was so impressed with him that he made him an honorary Spanish citizen.
Yeah,
how's that?
Right, yeah. But I know my Asian staff will be saying, well, why didn't you have some Bollywood music or something as well?
So tell us a little bit about we're going to hear now.
Oh, well,
440.
This is just a recent event. I was very recently, I was in Mexico for meetings and then went to Haiti, you know, to see our programs after the earthquake, and then went over on the other part of the island, really rather odd actually, to the Dominican Republic, odd in the sense of an earthquake and then actually a rather nice sort of beach holiday for a week afterwards. But as part of that week, I heard some of this merengue music, and I thought, well, this is rather good fun, and I really rather like that. And it does remind me of the Latin Americans and all their dance.
I think
life.
It takes you back to your Borodin too, because it's Pedir Sumano asking her to marry me.
Oh yes, oh nice, nice sort of romance in this as well. That's good.
Cielo azul.
If in doubt, have a good party.
Absolutely. I was going to say, if you had anything from this programme, it's that through all the strife and disaster, the human spirit often somehow shines forth, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. Everywhere I go, singing and dancing.
Juan Luis Guerra and Arpedias Humano asking for her hand. Juan Luis Guerra and 440, his band. So on that happy note, Dame Barbara Stocking, thank you so much for your choice of music.
Thank you very much. It's been great listening to all that.
Barbara Stocking was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the American attorney and best-selling crime writer Scott Turo. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
You're born an artist. You don't do it, it does you.
This is Leonora Carrington, the black sheep of my family. She's one of the few women artists whose work sells for over $1 million.
She's often very droll, the kind of curious mixture of grotesque and witty.
She's now the last surviving member of the original Surrealists.
Do you want a biscuit?
I remember her more than anything else. She was very keen on demons, and if there'd been an opportunity to sacrifice something, I'm sure she would have done it.
She did tapestries, she did paintings,
set designs, costumes,
wrote plays, wrote novels.
Have you ever seen yourself as a feminist?
Yes, I had three brothers, all bigger than me and stronger than me.
Joanna Moorhead looks back at the remarkable life of Leonora Carrington. Looking for Leonora. Today's Sunday feature at 9:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, a very good afternoon to you. This is Ian Skelly here on Radio 3 to guide you through the afternoon today. In a couple of minutes, we're off to Aldborough to the festival to hear music by Gabrielle and Schutz in the early music show. That's after a summary of the news this lunchtime. It's read by David Cornett.
Police in Tyneside believe that a gunman who's wanted for a double shooting yesterday has struck again, attacking a uniformed police officer. He's said to be in a critical but stable condition in hospital. Detectives believe the attack is linked to yesterday's shootings near Gateshead, which left a man dead and his girlfriend critically ill. Ministers are being asked to prepare plans for a 40% cut in their budgets. The Treasury says departments are unlikely to be asked to make such severe savings, but the exercise will inform future decisions. Labour says the news will raise fears about the future of frontline services and jobs. Five police officers were injured during several hours of disturbances in Belfast last night, in which stones, fireworks and petrol bombs were thrown. It was the second night police have come under attack while trying to separate rival loyalists and nationalist factions. A former soldier who was jailed for corruption in Afghanistan has been cleared of bribery. An appeal court in Kabul has acquitted Bill Shaw, who worked as the manager of a security firm. Mr. Shaw, who's 52 and from Leeds, insists that he paid officials a fine to recover two vehicles which had been impounded by the Afghan intelligence services. General David Petraeus has formally taken command of NATO forces in Afghanistan. Speaking in an official ceremony in Kabul, he said the war against the Taliban and other militants had reached a critical moment. He's replacing General Stanley McChrystal, who was sacked by President Obama last month after mocking US officials in a magazine interview. Researchers reveal that only 18 teachers have been struck off for incompetence in the UK over the past 40 years. The BBC's Panorama programme has uncovered evidence that instead of being removed from the register, incompetent teachers are allowed to resign and they then go on to work at other schools. The weather, wet and windy in Scotland and Northern Ireland, though it will become mostly dry in Northern Ireland by the evening. Wales and Northern and Western England will also be windy with rain for a time. South East England will stay dry but become rather cloudy. BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
David, thank you. Well, later this afternoon on Radio 3, Radio 3 Requests wraps itself in the Stars and Stripes, an American-infused edition for the 4th of July in an hour from now at 2. And later, Stephen Johnson explores the architecture of one of Tchaikovsky's best-loved compositions, his Piano Concerto No. 1. That's in Discovering Music at 5. But now it's time for the early music show, which will be introduced by Lucy Skeeping after this glorious motet by Giovanni Gabrielli.
applause there for Giovanni Gabrieli's monumental four-choir motet, Omnes Gentes Plaudite Manibus, so clap your hands, all ye people, performed there by the ensemble La Nuova Musica as part of the 2010 Alborough Festival. It was written to be heard on special feast days in the gloriously reverberant interior of St Mark's in Venice, where Gabrieli was principal organist during the 1580s. That performance, though, was given in the more intimate setting of Holy Trinity Church in Blythburgh in Suffolk, a magnificent building situated in a picturesque rural churchyard that dips down through a narrow brambly path to the estuary. In fact, Blythburgh was one of the earliest Christian sites in East Anglia. There's been a church there since the year 654, and the current one dates back more than 1,000 years. It's affectionately known as the Cathedral of the Marshes, and it's been a regular concert venue since Benjamin Britten spotted its excellent acoustics back in 1962. We'll be hearing highlights from La Nuova Musica's concert throughout today's early music show, mainly works by Heinrich Schütz. But before we get on to the main course, here's a little starter, a Capriccio by Johann Fehrdank, a musician who worked for Schütz at the Electoral Court in Dresden, first as a chorister and then as a player of that gentle-sounding early trumpet, the cornet.